Hot Air is a co-production of American University Washington College of Law and the American Bar Association. Any unauthorized use or distribution is strictly prohibited.
I'd like to move the discussion in a couple of different directions from this morning. I'm going to take it internationally, and I'm going to look at a different type of conflict, armed conflict, violent conflict, civil war, international war, internationalized wars, long-term strife. And I also want to look at how natural resources play not only into conflict, but into the post-conflict peace-building processes that take place. And as such, kind of thinking about how you move away from the brink, not just on the brink, but how do you move away from the brink to manage these conflicts and to manage conflicts that are not always natural resource-based, but natural resources can help in resolving those. There's been an evolution in thinking about the relationship between natural resources and armed conflict. Starting in the late 60s, early 70s, there was a lot of attention paid to the environmental consequences of war that grew out of the concern about the Vietnam War. Everything from seeding clouds to Agent Orange to defoliation on the ground through Operation Rome Plow. This led to a series of conventions and provisions within other conventions, including the Environmental Modification Treaty, Additional Protocols 1 and 2 to the Geneva Conventions. And fast forward 20 years to the 1991 Gulf War between Iraq and Kuwait, the setting of oil fires and dumping of oil into the Gulf, exploiting of Kuwait's oil resources, led to the United Nations Security Council establishing the United Nations Compensation Commission to adjudicate claims against Iraq for its illegal war. And that was not based on what Iraq had done during the conflict. It was all predicated on the fact that Iraq had illegally invaded Kuwait. And everything flowed from that illegal invasion. A few years later, there was a substantial growth in thinking around environmental security. What are the environmental causes of conflict? Thomas Homer Dixon and a lot of other scholars were arguing that the next wars are going to be over water, scarce resources. And how many wars have we had since then? And how many are related to water? And there's been kind of a re-looking at those arguments, a development of data sets. Uppsala and PRIO and other institutions have been collecting the data around that. And what we're finding is the theories that were advanced about greed and grievance over natural resources, those theories, they don't hold up so well in international conflict. But you see a lot at the local level, which raises a fascinating question, which I'm not going to get into. What are the governance mechanisms for that keep local level resource conflicts from escalating to become national conflicts or international conflicts? So we've talked about the environmental causes of conflict. This is a well-established field, a lot of scholarship. The environmental consequences of conflict. What happens after conflict? Well, it wasn't much of an issue for until the end of the Cold War, at which point you saw a rapid growth in the UN of peace-building operations. They didn't even call it that at that time. First it was peacekeeping, and then they realized that you can't just provide the police. You have to also help to rebuild the country. And so it's been an ad hoc growth of experience. And this is a growing area of practice, and the question I think that's relevant here is, what does this mean for law? And that's what I want to get into in this presentation. So natural resources contribute to violent conflict in multiple ways. A few statistics to give you a big picture. Since the end of World War II, in any particular year, between 40 and 60% of ongoing conflicts have been linked to natural resources in any particular year. In recent years, it's actually fewer, more toward the 40% than the 60%. But historically, only 25% of peace agreements for internal armed conflicts that have a natural resource dimension include natural resource provisions. It's often too hot a topic. It's the debate over how to share the resources or how to allocate land. These are too hot, and so they just don't negotiate them. Well, you then see a substantial risk of relapse, and it depends on which scholars you're looking at. If it's about a quarter or half of all conflicts relapse within the first 10 years. And a link to natural resources increases the risk of relapse, and it doubles the speed at which a conflict relapses. We have some developing theories about how natural resources contribute to the cause of conflict. These are related but distinct ideas around the resource curse and Dutch disease. And we've seen that in the last 40 years, developing countries that do not have major natural resources that grow between 2 and 3 times faster than those that have natural resource endowments. Similarly, as was highlighted in the 2011 World Development Report, slow developing, low income economies that are largely dependent on natural resources are 10 times as likely to experience civil war. And basically what you see is that there's no need to diversify your economy. You're sitting on mineral wealth or timber, and you don't grow the economy particularly in value added. This leads to concession irregularities, corruption, grievances. But a lot of issues around whether you have the value added sectors of a nation's economy, if those are able to grow or they atrophy as a result of the substantial natural resource components. So the natural resource-related drivers of conflict, we see a series of them: competition over resources, inequitable access, ownership, benefit sharing, lack of transparency, bad governance, that interact with other socioeconomic conditions, tensions, stresses. And then the question is, how does that country deal with these stresses? If it has a strong institutional framework, good governance, they're able to de-escalate the conflict and to resolve the conflicts. But where it's weak, this can lead to violent conflict. So this, I think, is what you see in the oversimplifications around the statements that Darfur was the first climate change-caused conflict. There was no doubt that Darfur suffered from 30-some years of reduced rainfall. There was a climatic stress. However, across the Sahel, about 16 other countries had the same climatic stresses. And in that period, only 3 other countries saw armed conflict. How can you say that climate change caused the conflict when less than a quarter of the countries actually saw conflict? It has to do with the institutions. It is related to climate. It was not caused by climate. And if you allow people to make that argument, that provides a defense to Khartoum that says, it wasn't our fault. This was conflict that was caused by climate change. It wasn't governance failures. It wasn't institutions. It was caused by climate change. As was noted this morning, though, conflicts over natural resources are not always negative. They can be an essential part of change. And when institutions to resolve conflicts break down and give way to violence, that's when we see the problems. How many people here have seen Blood Diamonds? Blood Diamond? Lord of War with Nicolas Cage. The idea of conflict resources have entered our lexicon. Blood diamonds, blood timber. In Somalia, there are blood bananas. Anything that provides a revenue stream, that can be tapped into by rebels or by governments, for that matter. But there's a question, a legal question, if a government uses its natural resources to wage war, is that illegal? They have a fiduciary responsibility to protect their state, to protect their people, and to use the resources at their disposal. The definitions that have been developed around conflict resources usually focus on non-governmental actors exploiting natural resources, and it may be direct or indirect, that feeds into conflict, that leads to either human rights violations or violations of international humanitarian law or other serious violations of international law. We have seen, there's a statistic here about, you know, since 1989, at least 18 conflicts have been financed by natural resources, at least in part. 89 is significant because that's ostensibly the end of the Cold War. You end the Cold War, you end the financing for the proxy wars. You end the external financing, and combatants start looking around for funding. The government has taxation and concession fees and things like that. The rebel movements do not necessarily have those sorts of revenue streams. And that's when you see a rapid growth. It was not the start of conflict resources, but that's when conflict resources took off. And it's everything from legal to illicit resources. Natural resources are often targeted during conflict, in part to deprive combatants of cover. And we saw this in the Kosovo conflict in 99 and, for that matter, in Vietnam. And that's a legitimate objective. The question is, do the means justify the objective? Notwithstanding that the objective is a legitimate objective, do the means that are used, including depriving combatants of cover, do they fail to discriminate? Are they proportionate? Are they consistent, in short, with the law of war? Natural resources that help to finance conflict often provide a target for the other side. You see the detonation of pipelines, the disruption of flows of resources. Natural resource targeting can also provide cover. The ostensible reason for the oil well fires here was to toss up a lot of black soot so that it would be hard for coalition forces to fly through it, to target, to see what was happening on the ground. That was the ostensible reason. It did provide cover. It did not provide that much cover, as we saw. I want to highlight this again because I think this is important, that across the cycle of conflict, you see well-developed areas for addressing environmental causes of conflict, addressing the environmental consequences of conflict, but it's still emerging, the field of environmental peacebuilding, the role of natural resources in the environment in helping countries to rebuild. While we see a substantial risk of relapse within the first 10 years, we know that we need to improve how we undertake peace-building efforts. And we have undertaken a four-year project to highlight how natural resources in the environment can provide opportunities for improving the effectiveness of peace-building. This project includes 150 different case studies and analyses by 225 authors from 50 countries. We are publishing them in a series of six edited books, starting in November of 2011, continuing through this year, totaling approximately 3,000 pages. This is an unprecedented collection of literature. This is not the first time people have talked about it, but this is the most comprehensive collection of scholarship by practitioners, researchers, and decision makers, drawing upon experiences in 61 conflict-affected countries and territories. And we have a seventh overarching book that synthesizes what all this means. You could see the countries where we really analyze the experiences. These are the six books. And we've tried to highlight the key resources here. So what are the high-value resources that are important? How do you manage them? What's worked? What's been problematic? Why has something worked in one place but not in another? Land. Land's one of the most common resources for peace building. It's also one of the most difficult ones to resolve. We have a book on assessing and restoring natural resources. This seeks to identify how to conduct assessments, and this is both assessments of the environmental consequences of the conflict, as well as the natural resource base that is going to be important for helping countries to rebuild. Other books address water, livelihoods, and governance. One of the challenges in this project, and we've been looking at how do natural resources affect peace building, post-conflict peace building in particular, and we focus on that window, this post-conflict window, because this is that chance. You have a chance to fix the drivers of conflict. You have a chance to stop the conflict cycle. If you're successful, eventually countries will go on to a standard development track, as you see in Mozambique. If you're not successful, there will be ongoing insecurities and or even relapse to conflict. There was a post-conflict Iraq. There was a post-conflict Afghanistan. We were not effective in how we undertook those efforts. One of the challenges in this research is, if we talk about natural resources in post-conflict peace building, what is post-conflict peace building? What's the conceptual framework? What's the operational framework? It doesn't exist. It happens. And this is what's so interesting. Peace building grew out of the end of the Cold War. And 3 days after, you had the Rio Declaration. You had Secretary General Boutros-Ghali publish the Agenda for Change that laid the blueprint for peace building. These two fields have been on parallel tracks from the beginning. But while the environmental side has had this proliferation of conventions and the blueprint for sustainable development in Agenda 21, you don't really have anything like that that really says, here's what peace building is. Here are the objectives, and here's how the different actors relate to one another. You're starting to see institutions identify areas, and this is our framework for peace building. Other people will say that there are five sets of activities. Some will say there are three. Some will say you have to distinguish between state building and peace building. So I just want to be clear at the outset that the framework that I'm about to walk through represents what we have developed. And this draws upon policy statements from the Secretary General, from the World Bank's World Development Report, from the CIVCAP report that the UN produced, from the USIP documents. There are four primary areas for post-conflict peace building: security, basic services, livelihoods and macroeconomic recovery, and governance and inclusive political processes. There are two related sets of activities. One is peacemaking, the negotiation and conclusion of peace agreements. We don't include this as post-conflict because that's actually during conflict. It marks the end of the conflict, and it sets up what happens in post-conflict peace building. Humanitarian assistance, similarly, in the conflict context, it, in theory, should wind up its operations at the end of the conflict. And then you move to regular development. The reality is that many humanitarian operations that start during conflict persist for years into the post-conflict context. And this influences where settlements are, how water is used, Some of the biggest settlements in Sudan are essentially where internally displaced persons congregated, often around cities or what were that initially towns that became cities. And how humanitarian assistance is undertaken affects many of the peace-building activities. This is just a short graphic that shows these are not discrete. There's substantial overlaps among these different activities. There are six key lessons that we find in our project. First, natural resources contribute to violent conflict in multiple ways. I talked about that a few minutes ago. Second, peace agreements more frequently include natural resource-related provisions. From 1984 to 2004, a little over half of the peace agreements had some provision related to natural resources. In the subsequent 6 years, all six of the major agreements, major peace settlement agreements, included resource-related provisions with a greater range of natural resources and a greater number of dimensions. The peace mediators are starting to see, wait a minute, we need to be looking at this. In most cases, though, the problems are not resolved in the peace agreement. They set up a process. So they don't decide how land is going to be reallocated. They say there shall be a land commission that should look into this. So you set up a process that then should, but is not necessarily implemented in the post-conflict period. Successful long-term peace building requires effective integration of natural resources into peace-building programs. That is to say, having natural resource-related provisions in the peace agreement is a good start. You still have to implement them, and there are implementation challenges. Flip side, even if you don't have a natural resource-related provision, it's still possible to undertake many resource-related activities in the peace-building process. Third, natural resources affect all of the major peace-building priorities. On the security side, you see a growing number of peacekeeping missions that have a mandate to address natural resources. And typically, 50 to 80% of ex-combatants return to agriculture. This can be a problem, because if the war has been going on for a while, land may be mined, there might be less land available, it may be degraded. Where are these former combatants going to farm? Basic services, water and energy access are frequently a top priority. And the flip side is that certainly for energy and also for sanitation, you don't see much investment in this until years after, which creates a source of grievance and general grumbling among the populace. And it delegitimizes the government because the government isn't able to provide these services. Livelihoods and macroeconomic recovery are perhaps areas where you see the greatest linkage to natural resources. And 80% of rural livelihoods typically depend on natural resources directly. You see overall employment rates in many post-conflict and conflict-affected countries, not just in rural areas, but overall for the whole country, 60 to 70% of the population depends on agriculture. More than 50% of GDP is generated by agriculture and by natural resource-related industries. Sometimes this is more than 90%. Exports, typically 50 to 80%, are based on natural resources. Sometimes this is extreme. Angola, in 2005, 96% of exports were oil and gas, and diamonds were 3%. Next year, as the oil and gas ramps up, it's up to 97.9% and 1.7% respectively. And you basically have an economy that's entirely dominated by oil, gas, with a little bit of diamonds. All other products are not there. It's not substantial for exports. It means that the government depends almost entirely on these sectors for revenues, And if the price of these commodities fluctuate, if it goes up, good for the country. If it goes down, there's substantial hardship. In terms of governance and rule of law, natural resource concessions and taxes, as I mentioned, are a substantial source of revenues for the government. Land and water disputes are commonly the most frequent source of conflict. And some of the governance challenges associated with resolving disputes over natural resources, especially land tenure, can overwhelm a government. You see this in Cambodia, where 1975, the Khmer Rouge essentially bans private property, destroys all the records, moves people around. 4 years later, Vietnam comes in, introduces collective property ownership. About 11 years later, UN assumes a stewardship role, and they have to help the Cambodian government figure out what to do with multiple series of people who have occupied property, who don't have claims to it, people trying to come back and claim their land. Literally hundreds of thousands of claimants in Phnom Penh alone. And the rural areas create their own problems because of the lack of infrastructure. So just to highlight very briefly some of the different natural resource and environmental dimensions of the different peacebuilding priorities. The post-conflict period creates a window of opportunity. This is an opportunity to undertake reforms to address grievances over allocation of land, over sharing of revenues between a producing area and the national government, spending of revenues, good governance. But this is a window of opportunity. It closes. And whatever decisions are taken or not taken in that window can be locked in for many years. Highlight this briefly. I can talk about it in question and answer if you like. But natural resource management is different in a post-conflict context. The context is very different. And how you go about it and what you do is challenging for a lot of environmental organizations who go into South Sudan or go into DRC. And they're used to undertaking efforts in a certain way, with certain tools. And you have to adapt those approaches to the post-conflict context, which leads me to the final key lesson. That's context is everything. You need to tailor the solutions to the particular place, not only to the post-conflict context, but even if something worked in East Timor, it doesn't mean it's going to work in Nepal. You need to be thinking about what the tools are, what the conditions are for making that work, and how to adapt or tailor those solutions to the particular context. So what does all this mean for international law? This is all well and good, but what does this mean for international law? Well, the law of armed conflict generally governs two aspects. Whether a country is legitimate in going to war, it's often called jus ad bellum, and how you conduct yourself during armed conflict, jus in bello. So you have this huge body of experience. Where on earth do all these peacebuilding missions get their mandate from? What are the rules that govern peacebuilding? We believe that we are about to see the emergence of a new body of law, international peacebuilding law. Some call it, those who like Latin, jus post bellum. We like to frame it a little more broadly. It's not just in the context of armed conflict, but it links to development. And it's based upon this substantial body of experience that continues to grow. And it is framed by these policy statements by the Secretary General, by the World Bank, and others. And if you look carefully at those, you could see a wide range of relevant legal provisions that this particular action is mandated by Security Council resolution. This action is governed by international humanitarian law. You see, all these different provisions that are relevant, but nobody said, here's the body, nobody said, here is the body of law that governs a post-conflict context. This has gone to sleep. Nope. Okay. So what are the sources of international peacebuilding law? Well, the peace agreements. That sets the framework. It establishes the procedures and rights and responsibilities of the different parties. Security Council resolutions, which draw largely upon the mandate from the UN Charter, particularly Chapter 7, but other aspects of the Charter are also relevant. Jus ad bellum, which influences some of the transitional justice elements and activities. International humanitarian law, international criminal law, human rights law, and environmental law. I'll talk about the international environmental law briefly, but the I also want to mention that there are some soft law instruments out there that are also relevant in this context. What role that plays in a body of hard law around peace building, we still need to determine, but the safeguard policies and operational policies of the World Bank and other Bretton Woods institutions, as well as the regional development banks, the operational guidelines of armed forces, including NATO, the Equator Principles, the Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative, Kimberley Process, and other non-legal initiatives also factor in here, and you see a lot of reference to them in the literature. So how is international environmental law relevant to this? First of all, this is a large body of international law. It's really grown in the last 20 years since Rio, some before. There's been a maturation, it's more effective. Why is it relevant here? Well, it provides a large body of norms, procedures, institutions that can help guide operations in a post-conflict context. You have to adapt it. It has to be integrated with these other bodies of law. But you see a lot of countries that use multilateral environmental agreements to engage with their neighbors, to engage with the international community. You see this especially for countries that have been either newly established or have been ostracized for a long period of time. Or have just not been able to engage because of conflict or other reasons. So you see Afghanistan, Serbia, Iraq, Timor-Leste, in the first few years after conflict, joining a large number of MEAs. Why on earth are they joining international agreements when they should be focusing on rebuilding their country? Well, this is part of rejoining the community of nations. It establishes legitimacy. It helps to mobilize resources to manage, it helps to mobilize technical and financial resources to manage your natural resources. International environmental law also provides norms and standards and procedures for UN peacekeeping missions. And it can be used, this body of law can be used in other ways similar to this, but I want to highlight this because this is taken to be the baseline for peacekeeping missions. And we can look at how international law, international environmental law addresses sovereignty, conflict resources, benefit sharing, and other aspects to inform what is done in a particular context on these issues. So how do we make this work? How do we move forward? Well, first, it's worth noting that just as peace building draws upon many different sectors, has many different objectives, international peace building law cuts across diverse bodies of law, and it's necessary to integrate across these bodies of law and across these institutions. Natural resources and environment are part of this. in part because they often provide an opportunity for integration. You look at timber management in Liberia. This is important for security. There's a source of conflict revenues. It's important for livelihoods, a lot of community forests, support for macroeconomic recovery. It's important for corruption and governance issues. Concession reform. One way to integrate across these different traditionally siloed peacebuilding activities is to work within the context of that single high-profile resource. So natural resources can provide an avenue for integrating these bodies of law. Second, we need to start articulating what this body of law is, even if we understand that it's a work in progress. Under what circumstances does it apply? When does it stop applying? If we have this transition from conflict to the post-conflict period to development, when's that end marker, and how do you transition from post-conflict to development? What are the various obligations and rights, and on whom do they rest? One way to do this is to continue to collect these experiences, distill and articulate best practices and policies. You see this evolution happening in UNDP. UNDP and a number of other agencies pulled together a fantastic handbook on DDR, disarmament, demobilization, and reintegration of former combatants. It's this thick. And they were showing it around Geneva, walked into UNEP, and they were saying, isn't this great? And the guy was flipping through and saying, this is fantastic. Really, well done. One question. Where are the natural resources? It was one of those moments where they just spent years working on this. And this shapes how DDR programs are undertaken around the world. And they hadn't thought about natural resources. The last 2 years, they've started to collect the experiences, starting to think about how do you integrate these experiences into the operational guidance. Now, it's just operational guidance. This is non-binding. But it shapes how things are done in reality. And as such, it provides kind of a soft guide for what's expected, which is a step toward law. There is, I think, one of the most interesting challenges in this whole debate is the fact that peace building seeks to promote peace. It seeks to stop the relapse to conflict. The mandate, as implemented, tends to go from the UN Charter to the Security Council, Security Council to the Department of Peacekeeping Operations. DPKO then decides who's in the room and what happens. This is securitized, that it all is justified on security basis. And this is why the UN is able to intervene in countries, why they're able to assert control over certain traditional governance structures and processes that would be that the UN normally is not party to. They usually are supporting. But in peace-building activities, often the UN plays a more aggressive role, a more intrusive role instead of aggressive, I should say. But this is also a barrier, that when you want to talk about peace building, in the run-up to Rio Plus 20, a number of organizations, including the Environmental Law Institute, noted that the peace building has a substantial natural resource dimension to it, and that the outcome document for Rio Plus 20 should address this. And there were a number of suggestions that different organizations made. The word peace, conflict, war, peace building did not appear in the first draft. Well, it's actually the zero draft. A lot of other issues were there. That did not. The number of missions to the UN have said, well, wait for the next iteration. But the fact is, there is a reluctance on the part of many UN agencies to talk about peace building, because that gets you into the realm of the Security Council and Security Council mandates. And so when you get away from UN headquarters, when you get out into the field, There's a lot of activity that's happening. It's a question of when you start articulating what the law is or what the law should be or what the policy is or how these things link together formally in the UN headquarters. That's when you get into trouble. Another challenge is that the peace-building activities and the different bodies of law do not map cleanly onto one another. And this is a practical challenge for identifying exactly how does this body hold together, what are the different pieces, what are the different institutions, who has what rights and responsibilities. I mentioned a little about Rio Plus 20. Rio Plus 20 is a once-in-a-decade opportunity to frame some of these issues. I expect that regardless of what does or does not happen at Rio, that there will continue to be political discussions around this. There's a growing body of literature on jus postbellum. The Peacebuilding Commission, which was established in 2005 by the Security Council, is continuing to take stock of lessons. The last couple of years, the light bulb has gone on in the commission, and they've started to talk about natural resources. Peacebuilding strategies for specific countries are starting to integrate natural resources into them. The Security Council is talking increasingly about conflict resources, about transparency and revenue flows. And we're seeing a development of a community of practice, of institutions, of policy, and of legal scholarship. And I expect that we will continue over the next decade or two to see an evolution of what, if I'm not mistaken, will emerge as a body of international peacebuilding law with a strong natural resource dimension to it. Thank you for your attention.
Okay, so I'll start off with questions. So in the collective volumes that you mentioned, did you look at any studies on how successful the provisions on natural resource-related issues in peace agreements, did you look at how successful those provisions have been implemented?
We did. One of the difficulties is quantifying these things. Mm-hmm. We have not quantified that, but we have analyzed how they are implemented, when they are implemented, why does it tend to be implemented, when it's not implemented, what are the barriers. So we have looked at them, it's more anecdotal, so you could see that it fell apart in this country for these reasons. In Sierra Leone, there was a land commission that was set up, and almost a decade later, it's met a few times, it's talking, there's still no progress, real progress toward implementation of the land reform. And part of the reason you see that is that this is the one issue that is likely to cause things to erupt. And so it's needed, but people are very afraid of it, too. I should say that one of the difficulties here is that this is a very messy process. And to honestly tease out a lot of the, to tease out rigorous results, there's so many variables. And it's very difficult to say with certainty, if you include natural resources in peace agreements more often, it will be more effective. We don't know. We have strong indications that it will. But there's a question of how you show that.
My question is, you mentioned about how the postbellum framework now doesn't really take into account explicitly natural resources in a lot of ways, and that to get around that, we've been supplementing it with other things. You mentioned Kimberley Standard, these soft law, customary law things, World Bank guidelines. So my question is, how do... If those are supplying some of the guidelines for this, how do we tailor those things, and how should these organizations or how should people be lobbying those organizations to formulate those guidelines in a way that are easily integrated and take into account what needs to be taken into account. I realize it's a big question, but I'd like to get your take on that.
Couple of comments. First of all, I should say that whether there is use postbellum remains a largely academic question. It's It's essentially the same question of whether there's international peacebuilding law. It's more a question of who's referring to the body of law. There are many existing sources that give a mandate for certain actions or require certain actions. And what I was trying to highlight is that some of these mandates are hard law, that a lot of the prosecutions for wrongful actions during armed conflict, including the looting of natural resources, this is rooted in hard law, in the International Criminal Court Rome Statute, in Additional Protocol 1 to the Geneva Conventions. I think that it would be a mistake to look only at the hard law instruments, that so much of this is done, it's guided by certain policies, and some of these may represent customary law. A lot of them don't represent customary international law, but they do shape what happens. And I think that as we're trying to frame what is international peacebuilding law, we should be thinking about what the norms that are enshrined in these areas. And I think that the question of how can people become engaged in this goes in a few different directions. One is to be thinking about what is international peacebuilding law, what are the different dimensions, what are the sources of law, how do the norms relate to one another, how do you weigh the obligations under international environmental law to be reporting every year with the fact that people have fled the country, there's limited capacity, there are all these other priorities. How do you weigh these obligations against the context? How do you, and for how long? How long do you give a country a pass on its obligations, and which obligations do you give a pass on? So there's kind of the theoretical side, and then there's more practical. And there are a number of organizations that are very actively involved, not so much from the big picture of how do we develop the peace-building framework, but more on specific issues. That you see this with Global Witness. Global Witness is very involved in a lot of these issues. They had been essential to the creation of the Kimberley process. And the Kimberley process, interestingly, was an attempt by industry to avoid having this become law, that they wanted to police themselves so that the UN wouldn't, so you would not have a treaty. And so it was a fairly successful process for a number of years, but in the last few years, you see it some with Cote d'Ivoire and especially with Zimbabwe, that the countries that, well, let's just say the Kimberley process is not taking measures that the advocates say they should be taking. And Global Witness actually withdrew from this. So there are a lot of opportunities, Global Witness is advocating on these things, trying to shame, trying to advocate, trying to push for this. Others like the Bank Information Center or Center for International Environmental Law are working on the Equator Principles. They're working on Extractive Industries Transparency Initiative. Some of this is a question of how does this work in the country. I would say one thing on EITI. I was in Timor-Leste in September and happened to fly in at the same time that the high-level delegation of EITI was coming in, and there were all these banners, and you know, Timor-Leste is EITI compliant, and they were making a big deal of that. And I think that's important. But EITI only requires disclosure of revenues for fees. So how much money did companies pay to the government, and how much money did the government receive? So you can just kind of, it's balancing your checkbook. what was the what was paid and what came in, and did anything go missing? That is really important, but that is not sufficient. And so I think that one of the things that needs to happen in terms of talking to the bank and to others is keep supporting EITI, but you also need to talk about how the revenues are managed. Not just getting the revenues in, but how they're managed. And particularly corruption around the use of those revenues.
In creating provisions for natural resources in peace building, possibly post-conflict agreements and things like that, what strategies exist to address the changing nature of natural resources? Because on the one hand, you want a durable, lasting peace, and hopefully a durable, lasting peace agreement. But on the other hand, natural resources by nature are often changing in quality and quantity. So in which ways can you address that in a peace-building mechanism?
That's a very good question. I think, let me first give a counterfactual. After World War II, there was a global shortage of coal and steel. And Japan, and you saw in Europe, the French and the Germans come together in the European coal and steel community, which became the foundation for the EU. The EU was founded on cooperation, post-conflict cooperation around two key resources. In Japan, they decided that because of this global shortage, and they needed coal in particular to rebuild the economy, they started this priority production system, PPS, that relied on domestic coal. Japan has relatively limited coal reserves. This was not a sustainable strategy. But they said, we don't have many choices, we will go with this one. And they went with what was inherently an unsustainable resource management strategy. And then 20 years later, as the coal reserves were being depleted, as you saw more coal coming online in other globally, they started closing down the mines. And then this led to a number of labor disputes, and they had to make adjustments, fairly substantial adjustments. But the point is that it may be necessary to unsustainably use some resources. That's one. Second, it may be necessary to adapt to a new reality. You see this in the Iraqi marshlands, that after the invasion of Kuwait, there is a international momentum to try to use restoration of the marshlands as a peace-building dividend. But Saddam had done two things. One, he had dried up the marshlands to take revenge on the marsh Arabs, risen up against him. But he also then put the water to use in agriculture. And post-2003 Iraq kind of liked using that water for agriculture. So it was very hard to get the main flow back. And on top of that, Turkey is building dams upstream, so there's even less water. So Iraq wasn't really wanting to restore it has to be nice to restore the full extent, but they had higher priorities. And I think it's a question of, in that case, what are you willing to accept? And how to balance those priorities? I think a more challenging question comes up in the peace-building strategy, where you say, what's the vision for a post-conflict country? What is the economy going to depend on? What are livelihoods going to depend on? How do we cooperate around resources? These different elements of peace-building. And you make certain assumptions. Now, the challenge I think that we're starting to face is with climate change and climate variability, that assumptions that are made then that lead to substantial investments might not stand the test of time. And I think we need to be, first of all, aware of that the status of the resource is going to be changing, not only from what it was before through the conflict period, but in the coming 10, 30 years. And so these resources, certain climatic changes may happen, which may lead to biotic and economic changes. Second, you want to make sure that there are early warning systems to monitor these things. Third, you want to diversify, that you want to be careful about relying too heavily on one particular resource. So it's a good question. It's a question that people are only starting to ask.
I've been asked to say a few concluding remarks, and I will keep it to 5 minutes or less, but I do have a couple things I do want to say to try to wrap up. And I want to go to the actual title of today's conference, which is Environmental Conflicts Along the Path for Sustainable Development. And for those that were here for my earlier panel, I urged you to think about conflict in a slightly different way. Not all conflicts can be bad. For those of you that, for instance, are parents in the room, you know that sometimes you need to have conflicts with your children, the same way perhaps as children you feel as though you might need to have conflicts with your parents. So not all conflicts are bad. And, of course, sustainable development, what is sustainable development? It is, in my view, development, which is capitalism, which is ultimately based on the value of greed. That is one of the ultimate values of capitalism. Remember the Wall Street movie, Greed is Good, with development, sustainable development, which connotates some notion of cooperation. So you have in the very notion of the title of today's conference, greed, cooperation, conflict of the age-old variety. And what I want to do very quickly in the 2 or 3 minutes I have left is talk about some of these values in a slightly different way so that you can appreciate all of the very lucid discussions of conflict over the course of today, perhaps in a slightly different light. Look at, for instance, the dichotomy between liberal and conservative in today's modern political world. You would, if you listen to TV, you would be led to believe that conservatives wish to drill for more oil, don't care about the environment, and things like that. Well, a conservative actually does want to conserve natural resources. A conservative does want to have the bounty described in the Bible for future generations. So you can see that even when you're talking about who is liberal and who is conservative and why we have conflicts between liberals and conservatives, even the very definitions sometimes don't make sense. We haven't talked much about science. Science has been a thread going through today, but we haven't talked about 350 parts per million, which is the number that climate scientists tell us we need to be worried about. We haven't really spoken about the viability of wildlife species. We haven't talked about the pH of our oceans, which continues to become more acidic. So there are some real scientific indicators of this conflict. However you come down on this conflict, it doesn't matter how you come down as long as you are attempting to come down and attempting to get your fingernails a little bit dirty on this. And now when you add climate change, existing climate change, change that's happening right before our eyes, you realize this huge blanket of uncertainty is now falling upon all of us. And so you get, just again by way of example, these surreal public policy debates where because of climate change that's already occurring, certain tree-eating bugs are moving into higher altitudes in the United States and actually throughout the rest of the world. And so the very same timber companies who always wanted to log those trees are now offering as a justification the reason why now, finally, the trees need to be logged is because of these bark-eating beetles. And so we're right back to square one, the very square we started with, over these types of natural resource conflicts. And I want to thank Carl so much for his presentation. My mind literally was spinning at several points when he was talking about his research, not only because of the research that he was showing us. I think that by itself was very interesting, but the ways in which the research that he's doing, I believe, or at least I found, had analogs to even domestic disputes, even within one sector of one country like the United States, these types of dynamics, these types of natural resource dependencies, this type of greed versus this type of cooperation can create this milieu of conflict that it's your jobs. I know not all of you are law students, but the majority of you here are law students, are lawyers to be. It is going to be your job to get through this Gordian knot with hopefully not too much blood and not too much carnage, to actually cut through the knot in a surgical way. And so my adage to you as you leave today, to seek this path of sustainable development along the inevitable conflict is, be specific with your facts, be persistent, be open-minded as well, and just like that gloriously vague comment or phrase, sustainable development, always engage in trusting skepticism.